court and options were limited. I could go the legal route and be stonewalled by the insurance company, or I could ply quick and dirty money from Guillermo and worry about the consequences later. Problem was, Guillermo, too, had stonewalled me on my visit to Nicaragua. By morning, I'd settled on a new angle. I knew from my visit to Nicaragua that Guillermo's wife spent 6 months a year in Palm Beach. According to Lindsay, that was the reason she hadn't known Guillermo was married. I wasn't sure I completely believed her on that, but he certainly could have led her to believe that he wasn't happily married. The important thing was that with just an introductory phone call from me that morning, Vivienne Cruz had agreed to a noon meeting at the historic Breakers Hotel in Palm Beach. "Mrs. Cruz," I said, approaching her at poolside. She was reclining in a chaise longue, wearing a bright yellow bathing suit that set off her dark suntan. The suit was cut high at the hips, giving her shapely legs the illusion of even greater length. She sat up and removed her designer sunglasses, revealing a face much younger than I'd expected. There were a few telltale lines at the eyes, but it was still clear that Guillermo had not married his high school sweetheart. "My, don't you look like your father," she said, smiling. "You must be Nick." We shook hands, and she settled back into her chaise. I sat in the deck chair facing her, the hotel in the background. The Breakers was a beautiful old hotel that evoked the grandeur and style of the Italian Renaissance, its impressive towers, ornamental stonework, and iron balconies inspired by the Villa Medici in Rome. The manicured croquet grounds were adjacent to the pool, and the ocean was just a short walk east, beyond the seawall. Aside from the usual old money, it catered to a wealthy international clientele, Arabs, Germans, and, evidently, pretty wives of rich Nicaraguans. "Something to drink?" she asked. "No, I'm fine." "I'd say you're extremely fine, but you still must be thirsty." She signaled to the waitress, who headed off to the bar for two of whatever Vivienne had been drinking. The extremely fine remark seemed calculated to rattle me, but I let it go. "I visited your husband in Managua a couple of weeks ago." "Oh, how's he doing?" "You haven't talked to him in 2 weeks?" She drew a deep breath, thinking, "Let me see. No. We've played message tag, but I don't think we've actually caught each other." She sipped the last of her drink. "Has he helped with your father?" "At first he was a big help, especially on site in Cartagena right after the kidnapping, less so as of late. I would have expected Guillermo to be right in the hunt. Honestly, I haven't asked him to do much. Don't be shy. I'm sure he'd be happy to do whatever you asked." "I'm a little nervous about asking."
"Why?"
I paused, measuring my words. "I've had some discussions with the FBI. Seems the Bureau doesn't have a very high opinion of your husband."
"No kidding."
The flip response took me by surprise. "Would you like to hear what they told me?"
"Why not? I suspect that's the reason you're here."
"They think he's sitting on a fortune in illegal money. From the looks of where you hang around on a typical weekday afternoon, I'm almost inclined to believe them."
"Don't be fooled. Guillermo's a cheapskate. I don't even have a membership here."
"Then how do you get in?" She glanced at the muscular young lifeguard posted at the entrance to the pool area, then looked back at me.
"Let's just say I give a great back rub."
"That's probably more information than I needed." She smiled as if enjoying the shock value.
"I'm not bragging, just being honest."
"Being totally honest, what if I were to tell you that the FBI thinks your husband is hiding drug money to the tune of about $10 million? She laughed as if it were ridiculous.
"He's been dodging those accusations for years."
"I'm hoping they're just accusations."
"Guillermo came into a lot of land after the revolution. He also found himself in a nasty divorce with his first wife. Every time he sells a piece of real estate, she's supposed to get half. It's a game they play. He makes a sale, he won't give her the money, she calls her lawyer. Then the race is on. He starts moving the money around, from company to company, from bank to bank, trying to hide it like, well, like a drug dealer. It usually ends with her going to the DEA or FBI, threatening him with trumped-up drug charges that never pan out. The waitress brought our drinks, gin and tonic with lemon. I sipped mine lightly since it was a bit too early in the day for me. I'm surprised my dad would let him move that kind of money through the fishing company. Between you and me, he does it without your dad even knowing it. The plain fact is, your father is a minority shareholder. Guillermo can do whatever he wants. Just so long as whatever he wants doesn't include drug dealing. No way, he would never. But he would try to cheat his ex-wife out of the money she's legally entitled to. The woman's a bitch. She's also the mother of his 8-year-old son and 6-year-old daughter, right? What's your point? I'm simply trying to get a feel for what he would or wouldn't do for money. Specifically what? The question stuck in my throat, but at this stage of the game, I couldn't be subtle. Did you know that it was Guillermo who sent my father to Colombia? No, but I don't see how that matters. This wasn't a random crime. The kidnappers knew that my father had kidnap and ransom insurance, and we think he was targeted for that reason. Are you asking me if my husband set up your father? I'd love you to convince me that he didn't. She took another one of those deep breaths that seemed to help her think. Seems to me that the issue isn't whether Guillermo sent your father to Colombia. The key question is who knew that your father had insurance. Are you saying that Guillermo didn't know? Her expression turned serious. I'm telling you that he did know. How can you be sure? I was sitting at the same table the day they discussed it. Where? Right here in Palm Beach. Back in August, we met here for a Sunday brunch. Your poor mother had the worst morning sickness I've ever seen. On her third sprint to the bathroom, I guessed she was pregnant. Your dad confirmed it, but swore us to secrecy since they hadn't even told you or Lindsay yet. Anyway, that's when Guillermo suggested he should look into kidnap and ransom insurance. A bit of friendly advice. A good thing for a new family man to have. You mean he bought insurance on Guillermo's recommendation? Actually, your father said he already had it. I did a double take. Technically, my father's telling anyone was enough to void the policy, but as a practical matter, it seemed reasonable for Dad to have shared that information with his own partner. Did he mention the amount of coverage? A lot, like 3 million. I looked toward the pool, sorting things out in my own mind. This doesn't exactly lower my suspicions about your husband. Did you expect me to lie for him? Stand by my man? Maybe. I'm through coming to his defense. I know he was sleeping with your sister. My eyes shifted toward the lifeguard she'd pointed out earlier, the one who got the great back rubs. She said, "He's a symptom of my marital problems, not the cause. I was faithful to Guillermo." I sensed genuine anger in her tone. I hadn't planned to be so blunt, but I saw an opportunity. "Do you think Guillermo set up my father?" "We all have our theories about what happened." "What's yours?" "A married, 50-year-old Casanova's obsession with his business partner's 20-something-year-old daughter. Two people were standing in the way of their getting together. Guillermo sends me to Palm Beach and sends your father to Colombia. So long as the shops are open on Worth Avenue, he knows I won't be headed back to Nicaragua anytime soon. Getting rid of your father was a little more complicated." "I've talked to Lindsay. I think you're reading way too much into her and Guillermo." "Are you sure?" she said, challenging me. I looked her in the eye, but didn't answer. She smiled thinly, seemingly satisfied that she'd made her point. "Neither of us can be sure of anything, can we, Nick? We weren't there." I was staring blankly, not really watching, as she applied more suntan lotion to her thighs. "I suppose not," I replied. She capped the tube of lotion and said, "Anything else I can help you with, honey?" "Not unless you have $3 million you can loan me." She leaned back and closed her eyes to the burning sun.
You're so funny.
Yeah, I said with a sardonic smile. I kill myself. Chapter 54.
You and Alex shared the same apartment? Asked Jenna.
We were having dinner together, our first opportunity to regroup since my return from Colombia. Over a glass of red wine and an appetizer of steamed mussels, I had told her all about the trip and she'd asked intelligent questions. This last one had seemed to leap from her lips as if she'd finally figured out the sleeping arrangements. It's a big place, owned by one of her friends, I said. Alex had one room, I had another.
You don't have to explain.
I feel like I do, you asked.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't have. I'm your co-counsel, not your... whatever.
The waitress brought us more baguettes, then smiled and said something in French as she left. Le Bouchon in Coconut Grove was one of my favorite bistros. It was a cozy place with wooden tables and chairs, Tour de France posters on the walls, and tasty French food at prices that even a guy who was hard up for $3 million could afford.
Does she ever ask about me?
Asked Jenna.
Who, Alex?
Yes. She must think it's strange, your ex-fiancé helping you.
She's never really said anything. Jenna smiled knowingly.
You're such a bad liar.
I smiled back. Okay, it might have come up.
What's her take on it?
I sipped my wine, tore off a piece of bread, brushed the crumbs away. Basically, I was stalling, wondering how she'd feel if I were to tell her that Alex's first take on Jenna and me was that I'd never really loved her. She definitely had the wrong idea about us at first, I said vaguely, knowing how completely wrong Alex had been. But she has a much better understanding now.
What does that mean?
She thinks it takes a pretty special person to step up and help me the way you have, and so do I. Our eyes locked for a moment, then a moment longer. It had been months since I'd looked so deeply inside her. It could have been awkward, but it wasn't. The waitress politely interrupted and took our plates. Jenna looked away, and by the time the waitress had left, so had the moment.
Tell me about Guillermo's wife, she said.
Ah, sure, I said, stumbling as I shifted gears. Once I'd refocused, it took only a few minutes to fill her in. When I'd finished, she asked,
Are you going to go after him?
How do you mean?
You were suspicious of Guillermo before you met his wife. The only missing piece in the puzzle was whether Guillermo knew for a fact that your father had kidnap and ransom insurance when he sent him on that trip to Colombia. Now you know.
It still bothers me that in court the insurance company pointed the finger at Lindsay, not Guillermo.
Maybe they suspect a lover's pact. Daddy didn't approve of the May-December romance, so they got rid of Daddy. While they were at it, they split a $3 million insurance policy with the thugs they hired to kidnap him.
There's no way Lindsay did that.
She took a little more wine, then said, If you're sure of that, then maybe you'll like my new idea.
What is it?
First, you have to tell me that you're sure about Lindsay. Because if we go this route and it turns out your sister isn't squeaky clean, you could end up sending her to jail for a very long time.
I'm as sure as I can be. And I hate to say it, but if I'm wrong, I guess Lindsay deserves what she gets.
She leaned into the table, seemingly excited about her pitch. Tell the government to forget about the immunity that Agent Hewitt has been offering you in exchange for incriminating information on Guillermo. Tell them you want reward money.
What kind of reward?
I did some research while you were in Colombia. The Diplomatic Security Service oversees a reward program for informants who come forward with information against international terrorists. Kidnappers are considered terrorists. If Guillermo set up your father, he's a co-conspirator, a terrorist in his own right.
Sounds interesting in theory, but we're pretty pressed for time.
They might bite fast. The FBI sure seems eager to nail him on something. Terrorism is a lot juicier than just another drug smuggling case.
Except that our pitch still has holes in it.
Such as?
Start at the top, I said. As far as we can prove, the only talk Guillermo and my father ever had about kidnap and ransom insurance was at the brunch where Guillermo's wife figured out that my mother was pregnant. That was back in August.
So?
These policies are country-specific. The trip to Colombia wasn't even on the map back then.
The original policy didn't cover Colombia?
Heck no, you don't buy coverage for Colombia unless you know for certain that you're going there. It jerks the price way up.
Then how did your dad get coverage for Colombia?
That came later. The insurance company issued a Colombia rider before the trip.
Couldn't Guillermo have been in on that?
We can't prove that he was. The policy was issued to my dad, not the company. The only thing we can prove is that two people knew about the extension of coverage to Colombia. My dad and the insurance company. My words hung in the air. We looked at each other, Jenna seeming to read my mind.
Maybe that's enough, she said.
Does it make sense?
Think it through. Why would an insurance company tip off rebels to kidnap one of its own policyholders?
It wouldn't. But a renegade employee might. She smiled, the proverbial light seeming to go on.
That would certainly give quality insurance companies something to hide, which would explain their scorched-earth litigation tactics.
I felt the excitement between us, but it was checked by the daunting reality that we both fully appreciated as lawyers. The question is, how do we prove it?
Chapter 55. I called Duncan Fitz in the morning repeatedly. Each time, his secretary insisted that he was unavailable. I knew that Beverly was simply running interference. She had a reputation for being difficult, but this was the same considerate woman who'd literally run me down in the halls of Cool Cash to warn me that she'd seen the memos and that I'd better be careful in my ill-fated meeting with Duncan and the henchmen from New York.
I don't want to get you in trouble, I said finally, but if Duncan won't take my phone calls, then let's assume that I don't want to speak to him either. Hypothetically speaking, is there any place I shouldn't go today just to make sure we don't run into each other by accident?
She paused. I crossed my fingers and hoped that God would reward me for those late work nights with Beverly when I'd smiled and listened politely as she droned on about all 9 lives of all 7 cats with whom she shared her one-bedroom apartment.
Well, hypothetically, she said.
Yes, I encouraged.
I suppose you shouldn't go anywhere near the inner loop of the People Mover before his 3 o'clock hearing in federal court. If you were to bump into him on the tram, you'd be trapped and couldn't get away. Wouldn't that be awful?
Horrible. Thanks for the warning.
You bet, she said, then hung up.
From 2 o'clock on, I perched myself on the elevated platform at the Brickell station. With the water table so close to the surface, the city of Miami has no subway, just rubber-tired trams that run on cement tracks elevated anywhere from 2 to 10 stories above the city. I stood to one side of the platform, behind the elevators, watching the trains leave every few minutes. Finally, I spotted Duncan climbing the escalator, toting his own briefcase for a change. The tram had stopped momentarily for loading and unloading, both sets of doors open. He entered at the set farthest away from me. I waited until the chimes sounded, then hurried out from behind my hiding spot and jumped aboard. The final chime sounded, the doors closed, and the tram left the station. Duncan and I were alone in front.
"Hello," I said.
He seemed surprised, but handled it with his usual aplomb.
"Mr. Ray, how are you?"
After working side by side for over a year, we were now on a last-name basis.
"I spoke to Judge Corven yesterday. She tells me that she was blackmailed off the case."
"That's absurd."
"It's true. She said it herself."
"I'm not in the business of blackmail."
"I'm sure you're not, but your client would do it behind your back. Quality Insurance Company has something to hide."
"Your family defrauded my client. End of story."
No, that's their story. Ask your client how they got the case taken away from Judge Corvan and reassigned to a judge who sits in your hip pocket. The answer isn't dumb luck.
Cases get reassigned every day. Not the way this one was. Look, I've been doing this law thing a little longer than you, Junior. Don't tell me how to represent my client.
Duncan, I wouldn't have this conversation if I didn't know you'd have a conscience. All I'm asking is that you do the right thing and ask your client the hard questions. It's no less than you would have expected from me as your protege. He stared out the window of the moving tram, silent. For an instant, I thought I was getting through to him, but slowly his disposition changed.
You're the one who should be asking himself the hard questions. I've heard plenty from the FBI. Now, stop following me around on trains, or I'll tell Agent Hewitt to add stalking to your list of indictable crimes.
His mind had been poisoned, clearly. It would have been futile to argue my innocence, but I was too angry not to say what I really thought of him.
Gilbert Jones killed himself, you know that?
Who?
The overweight cop. The last case we worked on together, after you made him gamble away his settlement money, playing Let's Make a Deal, he couldn't look at his children. He went home that night and turned off his oxygen.
How do you know that?
I guess you either know these things or you don't. Like the first hearing you ever sent me to, when I refused to go into court and argue that one of your other insurance companies didn't have to pay $50 a week for respiratory therapy because it technically wasn't physical therapy. Would that have been a victory in your book? Keeping a 12-year-old kid with cystic fibrosis from loosening the phlegm in her lungs so she could breathe?
You're making this personal, and you're going to regret it. It already is personal, and my only regret is that it took my father's kidnapping to open my eyes.
The chimes sounded, and the tram doors opened. Even though we were 5 stops away from the courthouse, Duncan started for the platform. On his way out, he glared at me and said, "This was low, even for you." He stepped off, the doors closed, and the tram pulled away from the station. It had actually felt good to air my true feelings, not just about the kidnapping, but about the kind of lawyer Duncan had tried to mold me into. But watching him through the window as he hurried down the steps to street level, my heart sank with the fear that another precious door had just closed on my father. For good.
Chapter 56. Matthew had no idea where he was. Without the benefit of pack mules, they'd marched deep into the valley. At the first sighting of a real road, the prisoners were blindfolded, first Emilio and then Matthew. They walked about another 100 meters, the barrel of the rifle poking him in the back, urging him forward. They stopped on command. He heard a car door open, and he was shoved into the back of a van. He heard Emilio bang his head and curse, which strangely comforted Matthew. At least he knew he wasn't going alone. The door slammed, the engine started. The van pulled away, a very bumpy ride at first, then a little smoother. It felt like the same road that they'd taken from Cartagena when this whole nightmare had started, but with the blindfold he had no way of knowing. "Emilio," he whispered.
"Silencio," said the driver.
He recognized the voice as Joaquin's. Matthew retreated into darkness, strangely deprived of more than just his sight by the thick blindfold. Bouncing in the rear of the van had put his entire equilibrium off. He lay on his side on the metal floor, the tires of the van whining just below his ear. Seated in front were at least 2 gorillas. Matthew sensed the presence of others, but he'd heard only 2 voices. The driver was definitely Joaquin, and he was pretty sure the other guy was Cerdo. He was complaining that his new street clothes were too tight, but Matthew's mind had already raced beyond the petty gripes. If they were wearing new clothes, they were leaving their guerrilla fatigues behind. Matthew knew what that meant. They were headed for the city. He tried not to start the emotional roller coaster, but his spirits soared anyway. A trip to the city would certainly be a sign that his release was in the works. The blackness behind the blindfold was suddenly a happy place. He saw Kathy's smiling face, his hand on her pregnant belly. He saw Thanksgiving dinner in Coral Gables with Nick and Lindsay at the table. He saw hot showers and razor blades and juicy sirloin steaks. He didn't care if silence was the rule. He needed to ask a question. ¿A dónde vamos? Where are we going?
¡Silencio! Shouted Joaquin.
It was risky to act up, but Matthew was tired of the abuse, tired of knowing nothing.
¿A dónde vamos? He asked once more.
The other guy, Cerdo, said something that made Joaquin laugh. Matthew didn't understand what he'd said.
¿Dónde?
He said. Neither one answered. Joaquin was still chuckling softly to himself. Finally, Matthew heard a whisper from Emilio in English.
He says we are headed for the hostage hotel.
Matthew retreated into dark silence. Somehow, it hadn't struck him as all that funny. Chapter 57. Dinner was at Mom's house. I worried about her a lot lately, and tonight's dinner only heightened my concerns. Since the kidnapping, we'd made it a practice to eat only in the kitchen, never in the dining room where she and Dad had normally shared dinner. Tonight, however, without explanation, she methodically set three places at the dining table, one for her, one for me, and one for Dad. I sat across the table from Mom, eating my beef stroganoff in silence, trapped by fear. It might have helped to talk things out, but I didn't want to risk showing Mom how worried I was. Alex and I were supposed to deliver the ransom in a matter of days, and I still had no idea where the money would come from.
Dinner was delicious, I said, as I planted a kiss on her forehead. My obstetrician says I'm not gaining enough weight. I make the most fattening food in my cookbook, and I'm still the skinniest pregnant woman in his office.
That's because you've hardly touched your food. Please try to eat something.
Her eyes drifted toward the living room in an empty gaze. I took my plate to the kitchen, then came back to the table and reached for the clean plate at Dad's chair.
No, she said sharply. That stays until your father walks through that door.
I backed off. Whatever helped her to get from one day to the next was healthy in the big picture, I supposed.
Have you talked to Grandma this week? I asked.
I saw her on Monday. She's slipping more and more each day. I doubt she'll know her son when he returns.
I know about that, I said, thinking of the way she'd booted me out twice. It's good that you visit her. Maybe it'll keep some spark alive somewhere inside her.
I hate the way she talks about your father. He was such a good son to her, and she somehow has it in her head that he's good for nothing.
Alzheimer's can make people say horrible things, things they don't mean.
I know. I went through a little bit of the same thing with your father when he used to drink. Every now and then I used to wonder if the disease was making him say things he didn't mean, or if it was unleashing his true feelings. Is that silly?
Totally, I said, as I squeezed her hand in mine.
I shouldn't even be thinking of that. Every day since your father has been gone, I've tried to remember the good times, but tragedy has a way of bringing back the bad times as well. Is it that way for you, too?
I could see the pain in her eyes. I moved closer, held her in my arms. Try to think of what's good, I said, hoping that she wouldn't notice the way I hadn't really answered her question. I felt like a hypocrite. There I was, telling Mom to think only good thoughts, when for 15 years I hadn't been able to purge my own heart. Ironically, the physical separation caused by the kidnapping had made me realize how stupid I'd been to let things fester all these years. The emotional gap between my father and me wasn't exactly oceans wide, but it was definitely born of the sea. Dad had always taught me to respect the ocean, but he'd pushed me to conquer all fears of it as well. Perhaps it was somehow connected to the loss of his sister in that boating accident, which I'd known nothing about until Jenna had told me just a couple of weeks before. Whatever the route, it had always seemed somewhat irrational to me. When he drank, it could get downright ugly. Alone in the family room, I felt my mind drifting. But I didn't want to go there. I had to follow my own advice and think only of the good times. I grabbed the remote control and started to channel surf, lying on the couch. 100 stations of nothing to watch, as usual. I switched off the set, and my gaze drifted toward my father's big saltwater aquarium across the room. The angelfish were fighting, as always, chasing each other around the submerged plastic shipwreck at the bottom. As a child, I used to imagine myself diving around that wreck
and pulling up treasure. I could see myself in mask and fins, knifing through the depths, the world's greatest diver who didn't even use tanks. A diver was what I'd wanted to be before my worst day ever with my father. Our last on the water together. I was 12 years old. Dad and I had joined a group of other fathers and sons on a boating trip to Biscayne Bay, skin diving for lobsters. I tried never to think of that day, and I didn't want to think about it now. But I was getting lost in that aquarium, lost in my past. Gulf Stream waters felt warm all around me, caressing my skin, making me almost giddy. Though completely submerged, I could glance up and see the sun. So clear was the water that intermittent clouds were actually casting shadows across the bottom of the bay. I was skin diving at a depth of 15 feet with a mask and snorkel, no scuba tanks, poking around some rocks. Other boys around me were gathering lobsters into sacks. We'd come upon a huge colony. The floor was moving with crustaceans. I saw a big one scamper over a grassy hump, then behind some rocks. I swam right to the hole and reached inside. Suddenly, an eel lunged from a crevice. I immediately pulled back, but its powerful jaws locked onto my forearm. I struggled to get away, but the rear half of the eel was coiled around a large rock. My diving gloves extended up to my elbow so the bite didn't break the skin, but the eel was too strong and I couldn't shake free. I needed to surface for air, but it was holding me under. In my panic, I was taking in water, a little at first, then huge mouthfuls. My father swam over to help. He poked at the eel with a stick, but it only tightened its grip on my glove. My father grabbed a rock and hit it. Its tail uncoiled from the rock that had anchored it, but the snake-like head was still staring me in the face, locked to my arm. It was at least 3 feet long, monstrous to me. Dad grabbed the eel and me, pulling us up. We broke the surface, and I gasped for air. I wasn't even sure what was happening. My arm felt numb, but the eel was still with me. Dad pushed us to the dive platform at the stern, then climbed up and pushed us into the boat. I was screaming, more shocked than in pain. The eel was flopping on the deck, refusing to let go. My father was screaming, too, at me. "I told you to never poke your hands in those rocks. Use a stick. Get it off me. If I hadn't been there to pull you up, you could have drowned. I'm sorry." I just wanted this awful thing off me. Even as a boy, I knew that an eel would never let go. The only way to get free was to cut off its head. "Cut it off," I cried. "You do it." Dad handed me the knife, but I was too afraid, too shaken. "Do it, Nick." "I can't. I can't." He grimaced and grabbed the knife, shouting, "Damn it, Nick, for one lousy day in your life, can't you just act like your father's son?" He lopped off the head. The long body fell limp to the deck. I rolled away, sobbing, more stunned by my father's words than by the bite of the eel. I was lying on the deck holding my arm, my lips quivering. I'd have a bad bruise for sure, but the diving glove had protected my skin. I looked up and saw immediate contrition in my father's eyes. He knelt beside me and took me in his arms. Tears were streaming down his face. "God, I'm so sorry, Nicky." I could smell the liquor on him. I didn't know which to believe, the outburst against me or the tearful apology. But it was too late for forgiveness anyway. I looked up and saw the stunned faces aboard the boat that had anchored beside us. I'd been utterly emasculated in front of my 5 closest friends and their very sober fathers. The chiming clock on the wall roused me from my memories. It was 9 p.m., and time was marching toward a deadline we might not be able to meet. But mercifully, time also had a way of healing. I had long ago gotten over the embarrassment of that diving trip, and Dad had won his battle with alcoholism. What had yet to be laid to rest, however, was the underlying fear that Mom had verbalized earlier tonight, that his drinking had perhaps unleashed his true inner feelings. In all honesty, I didn't always act like my father's son, but I was still his son, always would be. I vowed that when he came home, just as soon as he walked through the front door and sat down for dinner at the place Mom had set for him, I'd say those exact words to him. Finally, we'd be past it. "Nick?" my mother called. I shot bolt upright. It was almost 11, and I dozed off on the couch. "Come here." The urgency in her voice propelled me down the hall. I found her in the living room holding an envelope.
I just took out the garbage and saw this tucked under your wiper blade.
It was a plain white envelope. No addressee, no return address, no markings of an international courier service. It was unlike any of the past deliveries from the kidnappers. I opened it. Inside was a single sheet of paper.
"What is it?" asked Mom.
I read it, but the point didn't register. Just a guy's name and address. Jaime Ochoa.
Sounds Hispanic. You think he works for the kidnappers?
I started to answer, then stopped. The name was suddenly familiar to me. I checked the backside. Oh, my God.
What?
I don't think Mr. Ochoa works for the kidnappers. Check this out. She read aloud.
Nick, ask why he got fired. A friend.
She looked up at me and asked,
Who's a friend?
It was just a guess, but the only person who came to mind was Duncan's secretary. I smiled thinly and said, Thank you, Beverly. Part 4. Chapter 58. I was in Hialeah before the morning rush hour. I hadn't bothered with a phone call before starting out on the road. From what I remembered of my last meeting with Jaime Ochoa, hitting him cold was the way to go. The note was cryptic, but it was just enough to set my thoughts in motion. Jaime was the so-called psychic who sent me the email a little more than a week after my father's kidnapping, claiming to know his whereabouts. I'd thought it was a total scam. With this latest note, however, I had a compelling sense that Jaime really did know something and that his knowledge was linked to the vague question of why he got fired. I knocked twice before he came to the door dressed in shorts and a T-shirt, no shoes.
Hey, Mr. Nick, I knew you'd be back.
A predictable greeting from a guy who'd claimed to know everything. I wanted to follow up on some things. Got a few minutes?
Sure.
He opened the door and led me back to the kitchen. I entered carefully, checking for that Doberman pincher that had pinned me against the wall last time. I heard barking outside, looked out the window, and was relieved to see Sergeant chained to the doghouse. Jaime went to the espresso machine on the Formica counter and measured out a scoop of ground pilon.
Have you reconsidered my power package?
Let's not waste time with that psychic stuff again, all right?
I do know all.
But not because you're psychic. I was pushing it, but I had to pretend to know more than I did. It's from your other job, isn't it? The one you were fired from. He placed his espresso cup beneath the drip and said,
Jaime Ochoa has never been fired from any job.
I'm not talking about just any job, I said, still fishing.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Jaime Ochoa never worked for Quality Insurance Company.
My heart raced. He was in denial, but at least he'd confirmed my suspicions that we were talking about Quality Insurance. That's not what I hear, I said, bluffing.
Then you heard wrong. Jaime Del Pina was fired from Quality Insurance, not Jaime Ochoa.
Who's Jaime Del Pina? The little espresso cup was full. He downed it in one swallow, then said,
Yours truly.
You changed your name?
They made me change it.
The company?
Claro.
Why would you let them do that?
Because they gave Jaime Del Pina a choice. Go to jail or disappear.
I'm pretty sure I know the reason, but you tell me, why do they want you to disappear?
He smiled thinly. Sorry, my friend. For the rest of the story, I must tap into my inner clairvoyance.
Huh?
That's all you get for free, Jack, he said flatly.
You expect me to pay you money?
Absolutely.
That's extortion.
It's just business.
Not when the business is kidnapping. Maybe I'll call the state attorney and see what she thinks it is.
You'd be a fool to do that.
Watch me, I started for the door. Hold it. I stopped. He said,
Let's be reasonable about this. The policy limit is $3 million. You'll probably deliver the ransom by pack mule through 2 or 3 intermediaries. Do you honestly think the kidnappers will even notice that you slipped a little something to me?
You've seen the policy, haven't you?
That's how you know it's $3 million. I told you, I know all.
And you're going to tell all, too.
Surely, for $50,000 cash.
I don't have to pay you 50 cents. I'll subpoena you, and I'll forget everything I know.
With that, something snapped inside me. I was tired of being extorted by kidnappers and scumbags like Jaime. I started toward him and said, "Maybe I'll just beat it out of you."
"Bad move," he said as he grabbed a big kitchen knife from the counter.
I stopped cold, then took a step back.
"Take it easy, pal. I wasn't serious."
"You looked serious.
There's no need for a knife. I don't see any other way to keep you from walking out that door."
"Just let me pass, all right? Can't let you go to no state attorney. I changed my name to stay out of prison."
"No one's talking about prison.
I seen what they did to my brother in his cell. Guys like us don't do well in prison. Somebody's boy."
"You don't have to explain. Just put the knife down."
He was grimacing, almost whining, slowly unraveling before my eyes.
"Damn you, why did you have to go and threaten me like that?"
"Let's forget it, okay?
A little money, that's all I wanted, just a small percentage, and you turn around and threaten to put me in jail."
"Just put the knife down. I won't say anything to anyone."
He laughed mirthlessly.
"You expect me to believe that?"
"I promise."
"Promise,"
he said in a sissy voice, mocking me. Slowly, all traces of sarcasm drained from his expression. In his rage-filled eyes, I could see that he felt abused, perhaps more by his former employer than by me. At that moment, however, I was the only target in front of him. In a weird way, he must have seen himself as the victim.
"Please, Jaime, don't do something stupid."
"You're the stupid one."
He charged across the kitchen and came at me, leading with the knife. I dodged out of the way. He fell, but sprang right back. I had my hands in front of my body defensively. A perverse smile came across his lips as he began to toy with me. We moved strategically in a circle, like two boxers looking for an opening. He kept lunging at me and pulling back, taunting. Blood oozed from a cut over his right eye. He'd apparently injured himself in the initial fall. He wiped it away, then suddenly seemed to realize that the blood was his own.
"You son of a bitch!"
he shouted as he lunged toward me, swinging wildly. The knife cut through my shirt sleeve, and I felt the sharp metal against my skin. It was just a glancing blow, but it sparked my survival instincts. Somehow I found the strength and quickness to grab his arm. Locked together in a struggle for the knife, we whirled across the kitchen and slammed against the sink. I hammered his wrist against the basin, hard. Once, then again, the third time I heard bones pop. He cried out in pain as the knife fell to the floor. He gouged my eye with one hand, but his injured limb was hanging limply. Still pinned against the sink, I grabbed the good arm and twisted it behind his back in a half-Nelson, then wheeled him around and shoved the broken hand down the opening to the garbage disposal. He screamed as his knuckles met the sharp, still blades. I shoved even harder, jamming his hand deeper into the disposal. Finally, he was in up to his elbow. His arm was stuck and he couldn't pull it out, not even after I let go. I kept his other arm locked behind his back as I reached for the switch.
"I'll turn it on." "No, not my hand."
"Then talk.
Let me go. I'm begging you, man. I'm your friend."
The word friend made me think of the note. Maybe it hadn't come from Beverly.
"Are you saying you're a friend?"
"I'm your only friend, man."
I wasn't sure what he was saying, but I wasn't backing down. The cut on my arm was throbbing and bleeding. He'd sliced it deeper than I thought.
"Tell me what you know, or I swear I'll grind your fingers to the nub."
He grimaced, shaking his head defiantly.
"No, no, man, not for free.
Don't make me do this, please.
You got till the count of 3. 1, 2. "Okay, okay,"
he said, his whole body shaking.
"I'll tell you anything you want to know."
I took my hand off the switch and prepared to listen. Chapter 59. I had everything, but in effect I had nothing. That was the legal conclusion Jenna and I reached in her office that afternoon. Jenna was seated behind her desk. I was in the silk wing chair facing her. She'd listened to my detailed account of Jaime's confession without much apparent amazement, as his story jibed with our own theory. It was an inside job. "We have the same problem we've always had," I said. "How do we prove it?"
You think Jaime's long gone?
Absolutely. He was happy to sell me information on the sly, but he wasn't about to walk into a courtroom and testify against Quality Insurance Company under any circumstances. He's terrified of them.
The way they strong-armed Judge Corvan into recusing herself from our case, I guess he has good reason to be afraid.
Even if I could somehow corral him, could you imagine the cross-examination?
Jenna was right with me, breaking into role.
Mr. Ochoa, exactly how close did your hand come to being ground into a quarter pounder before you spit out the lies that Mr. Ray wanted to hear?
Her saying it made me wince. I wouldn't have actually done it, you know.
Done what?
Flipped the switch.
I wouldn't have blamed you. The creep handed your father over to kidnappers.
I stared out the window, thinking.
Jenna said, Have you thought about making good on your threat to Jaime? Why not go to the state attorney?
I need $3 million by Sunday. Can you think of anything that would make a company circle the wagons and pay me nothing faster than the threat of a criminal investigation?
I suppose you're right.
I rose and started pacing across the oriental rug. There has to be something we can do.
I don't know what, short of finding another witness.
I stopped. A wry smile came upon me as I looked at her and said, Now, that is a great idea. Chapter 60. Matthew smelled rum. He was in the slow, disorienting transition between dreams and the dark reality of life behind a blindfold. And he thought surely that his mind was playing tricks as he woke. His last cocktail had been more than 15 years ago, but he could have sworn that a strong Cuba Libre was right beneath his nose. He raised his head from the floor and sniffed the air, giving up the sauce hadn't robbed him of his memory. The place definitely smelled of rum and coke. A screech pierced his darkness, the shrill sound of a chair sliding away from the table on a hard tile floor. He heard footsteps, and it finally registered that he was no longer in the van. He had no memory of being moved into a building, and he couldn't possibly have slept through that. The throbbing pain behind his eyes made him guess drugs. As the footsteps drew closer, he instinctively raised his hands for protection. Chains rattled. The slack quickly disappeared, and metal handcuffs pinched his wrists. His wrists were cuffed in front of his body rather than the more restrictive behind-the-back method, but the range of motion was still only about a foot.
Buenos dias!
The slurred Spanish had sounded like bad Castilian. The voice was definitely Cerdo's, but the inescapable breath was Bacardi's. As hot as this room was, Matthew surmised that the sweat oozing from his captor was about 80 proof. Matthew answered in Spanish, Man, how much have you had to drink?
Enough to make me wish you were Nisho.
Just the smell of this pig had him pitying poor Nisho. You're going to wish you'd never laid a hand on her. Where are we?
Can't tell you.
How long was I asleep?
A while.
How long do I have to wear this blindfold?
As long as I say.
As stupid as he was, Cerdo could handle questions with the skill of a politician. Just take it off, would you? I already know what you look like.
True,
he said. Cerdo's thick fingers fiddled with the knot behind Matthew's head. The blindfold fell from his face. His eyelids fluttered in the sudden burst of light. The room was dimly lit, but the adjustment from total darkness came slowly. It seemed to take forever for him to focus, and even then he had to alternate eyes, closing one and then the other to alleviate the discomfort. Images slowly began to materialize. He was on the floor, chained to the frame of a metal bed with a lumpy mattress and no linens. The small room had no other furniture and no window. The walls were filthy, paint peeling away, graffiti everywhere. He could only guess at the original color of the floors that were so dirty. The only source of light was a low-wattage bulb hanging by a wire from the ceiling. The door was open, and in the hallway outside were a chair and a small table, Cerdo's guard post. His eyes turned back to his captor, settling on the hideous paisley pattern tattoo that covered the left side of his face. This close, Matthew got a full appreciation of the tattoo's purpose.
It did a fair job of hiding a ghastly scar that started at the corner of Cerdo's mouth, curled back across the cheek, and then up over the ear. It looked as though, years ago, someone had tried to remove the skin from his skull with dull scissors.
"What are you looking at?"
Matthew rubbed his eyes. "Nothing. Takes a little getting used to the light, that's all."
"I could put the blindfold back on you."
"No, that's all right." He tried to hand it up, but with the chains he could only reach so far.
"Keep it," said Cerdo. "You may want it."
"For what?"
"When families don't pay, Joaquin always shoots his prisoners in the face. 7-8 times. He never returns a handsome corpse."
Matthew had hoped that release was near, but now he feared a snag. Cerdo shaped his hand into a pistol, aiming at Matthew's nose. He made a clicking noise, as if to pull the trigger, then tossed the blindfold in the prisoner's lap.
"Believe me, those last 10 seconds, you'll beg for one of these."
Matthew was more sickened than afraid to think that good lives had ended at the hands of this worthless thug. Cerdo snatched back his gift and stuffed the rag in his pocket.
"What the hell was I thinking? Joaquin doesn't allow blindfolds."
He laughed at his own joke as he crossed the room, then hit the light switch and closed the door on his way out. Matthew sank low to the floor in total darkness. It was no better or worse than being blindfolded. The whole exchange had gained him nothing save the unwelcome insight into how he might die.
This ends Disc 9. A King's Ransom, Disc 10.
Chapter 61. It was almost 10 p.m. and Jenna was still at my place. We'd filed an action in federal court that afternoon. An emergency hearing was set for 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, and we'd been preparing all day, even working through dinner. It was a long shot, but it was clearly my last chance.
"Ouch," I said.
She was changing the bandage on my arm. Luckily, I hadn't needed stitches, but the knife wound was pretty ugly and sensitive.
"Double ouch," I said as she dabbed it with alcohol.
Men are such wimps.
"Give me a break. I was stabbed."
"You were scratched. I've done more damage to myself with an eyelash curler." She reapplied the butterfly bandages. "There, all set." I checked it out.
"Nice work. Do you do back rubs?"
"I think you know everything I do and don't do." It was one of those half-serious, half-flirtatious remarks in her Kathleen Turner voice that I hadn't heard in a long time. It left me speechless. "Sorry," she said. "I think that crossed the line."
"It's okay. I'm not really sure where the line is anymore."
I sipped my beer.
"You mind if I ask a personal question?"
"Depends on what it is."
I took another drink, a longer one this time. "Have you dated anyone, you know, since we broke up?"
She smiled coyly, as if she'd been expecting that question for some time. "Actually, no."
"Me neither."
She gave me a serious look. "I didn't see much point in getting to know anyone new here. I'm moving to Tampa."
"You're what?"
"I listed my townhouse a few weeks ago. As soon as it sells, I'll be moving back."
"Wow. That's amazing."
"It's where I grew up. It still feels a little like home to me there."
"Sure."
"I talked to my partners. They're all for opening a Tampa office."
"Sounds like you have it all figured out."
"It just seemed like the right thing to do at the time."
"Does it still seem like the right thing to do?"
She dropped her egg roll. Jenna was a natural with chopsticks, so my pointed question had made her nervous, clearly. "I don't know."
I wasn't sure where to go from there, but she didn't seem comfortable with the direction so far. "So how much are you asking for the townhouse?"
"Why? You want to buy it?"
"No, but I don't want to see you get hurt in a fire sale. It's a really nice place."
"How much do you think I should ask for?"
"Just don't grab the first offer. It might mean having to stay here a little longer, but I'd hold out for maybe 6 million.
"You," she said, smiling. She uncrossed her legs, rose from the floor, and started clearing away the empty Chinese food cartons. I grabbed the empty bottles and followed her into the kitchen. The conversation seemed unfinished, but I sensed that she had enough on her mind already.
"Are you feeling any better about tomorrow's hearing?" I asked, shifting gears.
"Honestly, no. We're going to be bounced out of court so fast it's not funny."
"Just trust me, all right?"
The phone rang, which made me flinch. Lately, every time it rang, a part of me expected the worst. I placed the empty bottles in the recycling bin and grabbed the phone on the third ring.
"Hello? Duncan Fitz here."
He said it as if he were the President of the United States. "Nick Ray over here," I replied with equal self-importance.
"What's this crap you served on my client this afternoon?"
"It's called a complaint and an emergency motion to prevent Quality Insurance Company from intimidating witnesses."
"That's preposterous. My client has done nothing improper."
"Then you have nothing to worry about."
"Look, you can't just bounce around from state court to federal court."
"I didn't file in state court, you did. And that was nothing more than an action to enforce the confidentiality provisions of the agreement. That's over."
"We'll still oppose this."
"I'd expect no less from you. But once a federal judge hears our newly discovered evidence, we'll have a whole new ballgame."
"What evidence?" he said, scoffing.
"You'll hear it all at tomorrow's hearing."
"Are you planning to call witnesses?"
"Just one."
"Who?"
"Me." He laughed, then it faded.
"You're not serious."
"Here's your chance to tear me to shreds." He paused, then said smugly,
"I'll look forward to it."
"Forget what I said about opposing the hearing. This is going to be fun." The line clicked, and he was gone.
"That's what you think," I said, as I hung up the phone.
Chapter 62. Jen and I reached the big center courtroom a few minutes before the scheduled 2 o'clock hearing. We were in the oldest section of the federal courthouse, which was also the most beautiful, done in the Mediterranean style with colorful frescoes on the arched walls and ceilings. The center courtroom had the largest area for public seating, big enough to accommodate events like the investiture of new judges or the trial of a Panamanian dictator. It was an impressive place, even for the most jaded of lawyers. Yet as I sat waiting at counsel's table with Jenna at my side, the cavernous surroundings made me feel even smaller in relation to Quality Insurance Company. "You still worried?" I whispered.
"I told you from the beginning you can't just take the stand and repeat everything Jaime Ochoa said to you. It's all hearsay. It won't come into evidence."
"Maybe Judge Weinstein will cut us some slack."
"Maybe she'll spit in my eye."
We heard a knock and a side door opened.
"All rise."
Jenna and I were immediately on our feet. Standing at the other table, farthest from the empty jury box, was Duncan Fitz. Beside him was the one lawyer at Cool Cash who seemed to hate me more than my old boss did, Maggie Johans. The judge settled into her leather chair as the clerk called the case and announced, "The Honorable Judge Sylvia Weinstein presiding."
"Good afternoon," the judge said. "Please be seated."
She spoke without looking up from the open file before her, making eye contact with no one. I might have felt a little better had she glanced my way and conveyed just a hint of sincerity in her greeting, but it wasn't her style to buddy up to lawyers in any fashion. Judge Weinstein had a reputation for being a scholarly thinker and a sharp-tongued talker. I supposed that was a step up from state court where we'd had to settle for spineless and corrupt. Finally, she peered out over the top of the gold-framed reading glasses that had slipped down to the tip of her nose.
"I have read the motion that is the subject of today's hearing," she said. "Witness intimidation is a serious charge. Frankly, there is virtually nothing in the filed papers to support it. I scheduled this emergency hearing only because of the immediate danger faced by Mr. Ray's father. While the court is sympathetic to his plight, the plaintiff had better have some evidence."
"We do," I said. "Then call your witness."
Jenna rose slowly, as if she were headed for the gallows. She clearly didn't believe in the plan, and now that we were actually in the courtroom, neither did I.
I realized that desperation had blinded me and that Jenna was right. No way could she put me on the witness stand and fight off Duncan's objections. I stopped her with a gentle touch, then looked at the judge and said, "The plaintiff calls Maggie Johannes."
"What?"
said Duncan, rising. Jenna shot me an equally surprised look. Duncan said, "I spoke with Mr. Ray last night, and he told me that the only witness he and his girlfriend planned to call at this so-called hearing was himself." "First of all, Miss Davies is my co-counsel, and I would appreciate it if Mr. Fitz would show her the respect of not referring to her as my girlfriend."
"That was rather tacky,"
said the judge.
"I apologize, Your Honor."
"More important," I said, "had Mr. Fitz told me that Miss Johannes was planning to fly down from New York to be in the courtroom today, I would have told him differently." The judge shrugged, nonchalant.
"That's the way it goes, Mr. Fitz. I've seen lawyers pluck witnesses out of the balcony. It's the risk you run if you show up in the courthouse. I'm afraid we may have to put your girlfriend on the stand."
"But this is not an ordinary witness. Miss Johannes is a lawyer and—"
Maggie tugged his sleeve, interrupting.
"Excuse me, Your Honor."
Duncan stooped over to take her comment. Maggie cupped a hand to her mouth to prevent the judge from hearing, but she whispered loudly enough for me to overhear. I presumed it was intentional.
"How many jury trials has this kid had?"
I didn't hear Duncan's answer, but I did see the smile on Maggie's face. He straightened up and said,
"In the interest of bringing this hearing to a rapid conclusion, Miss Johannes will take the stand."
Maggie rose, stepped around the table, and shot one quick glance at me as she passed. It wasn't overdone, just a subtle signal that I couldn't get a thing out of her with a blowtorch.
"Swear the witness," the judge said.
Maggie raised her hand and recited the oath, placing particular emphasis on the words, "the whole truth and nothing but the truth." She'd said it with such genuine conviction.